Statewide satellite distribution of this program is made possible by the Lawrence Group, providing residents throughout New York State with total insurance coverage.
This program is a production of WAMC News. From Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly half-hour review of New York State government and politics. Your host is political scientist and syndicated columnist Dr. Alan Chartock of the State University.
Hello and welcome to the Legislative Gazette. This week we'll look at a proposal to test 100,000 New Yorkers for AIDS. We'll also hear about a controversial 300-mile gas pipeline project that will cross northern and eastern New York. There's been another senator involved with possible misconduct. We'll talk with a colleague who defends him, and I'll chat with Lieutenant Governor Stan Lundeen. But leading off this week is a justice of New York State's highest court. Judge Joseph Bellicosa is one of the seven people Governor Cuomo has appointed to the State Court of Appeals, making the governor's stamp on the judiciary almost indelible. I spoke with Judge Bellicosa this week and asked him how he was enjoying serving on the court.
Very much. It's everything anyone could have hoped for. It's a joyous opportunity and a tremendous challenge.
One of the things that you and I have talked about is the mandatory retirement age. Recently, there's been an, up to now, it's been 70 years, and you're off. After all, that's how you came on the court. This has been a new wrinkle in the federal, in the congressional legislation, which may affect all of this. Could you tell me about it?
Yes. With respect to high-level appointments, federal statute now provides protection for such individuals so that they cannot, on an age discrimination basis, be removed even under a state constitutional provision by reason of reaching 65 or 70 or 75, whatever it may be. The exceptions that they have are for high-level policymaking elected officials or appointed officials, but they're very few, so that the largest bulk of your appointive officers and employees in this state's government and throughout the nation will be able to stay on past the normal retirement ages that we've become accustomed to over the years.
Joe, is this good or bad?
Well, it's a mixed bag, like a lot of things. I think it's very good because, in one respect, in the sense that it still provides an opportunity to draw on the tremendous experience and the talents of individuals who, in our age, don't dry up and become useless at age 70. In fact, it's unfortunate many times that those to whom that happens end up in retirement, perhaps getting very, very unhappy and down, depressed, ill, and all the rest of it. The other side of that is, to the extent that that's going to close off opportunities for fresh individuals, new, young, vigorous individuals, to provide a proper mix, that is going to be a problem in connection with the implementation and application. Somewhere, there's going to have to be a refinement of that to make sure the mix continues to some extent.
One of the ways that you do that sometimes is in the appointment of who you have as a clerk. Who do you have as clerks?
I have two law clerks, one of whom worked for me when I was chief administrative judge, a young lawyer out of Albany Law School. She was terrific as a researcher on legislative problems, and I took her over as my first principal law clerk at the Court of Appeals. And the other is a young man who got out of Syracuse Law School a few years ago and was working as a counsel in the Parole and Department of Correctional Services, and I brought him over. They will be with me for two-year stints, usually.
Now, after those 2 years are up, then they go and you get somebody else. Is that one of the ways to keep the breath of fresh air coming in?
That's one of the ways for a judge to keep fresh in having different people with different ideas coming out of the law schools, yes. And what you would do as a judge is interview people coming out of the law schools then who would be in their second year looking for when they graduate to come on as law clerks. And the graduating law clerks usually go into some other form of either state government and state service, public service, or into private law practice, many of them.
Let's talk about your old pal Mario Cuomo for one moment. He said when he appointed you that there were times in the past that the court had ruled against him. He said sometimes unwisely. When you make a decision and you know it's clearly antithetical to what the governor believes, does that make your skin sort of stand up a little bit on the basis here is a guy who has elevated you to the highest court in the state of New York? Does it give you any personal difficulties?
No. First of all, I'd say he never said that we were unwise. He said that sometimes they're incorrect. I think there is a very subtle difference between the two. He has too much respect for the court, and that's why, and for the process of the court. And that's why I don't have any concern about that. Where we would differ, as we have many times, by the way, on administrative matters, on additional judges, courthouse facilities, the budget, you differ respectfully, openly, hard, and he's used to that combat from the courtroom, and he respects it. So in turn, I don't have difficulty or get edgy if I have to decide something that I think he might have a different policy view on.
You're a former professor. He's a former professor. St. John's Law School. Is St. John's, as a result of this, going to become the preeminent law school in New York State?
No, I have a son there who's in his second year, and I hope he'll make it that somewhere down the road. But I think it's just a fine, fine law school, and it certainly has done us very well.
Judge Joseph Bellicosa of the New York State Court of Appeals. Early this week, Governor Mario Cuomo announced that the state health department will spend several millions of dollars on a new program to measure the spread of AIDS, acquired immune deficiency syndrome, in the general population. Dave Galletly has our report.
The state health department says the program, which will take 6 months and cost $3.4 million, will anonymously test the blood of over 100,000 people in the state to more accurately measure the scope of the problem. Fran Tarleton, spokeswoman for the state health department.
I think it's important to think of this not as a screening process where we're testing specific people. We're taking a random sample of blood specimens that for the most part would have been taken from people for other reasons, in a hospital setting, in a clinic setting, maybe prenatal care, maybe family planning, people who are being treated for sexually transmitted diseases. So we are not going to be using blood specimens that have any names or any identifying information attached. Therefore, they will be anonymous, and there would be no way to inform the individuals involved. This is not a test of individuals or specific people, but an analysis of blood samples from a variety of sources to try to get a clear picture of how widespread infection may be.
Reaction to the testing has been consistently positive from all observers we contacted. Dr. Neil Zepkowski, director of the Family Health Center at Schenectady's St. Clair's Hospital and a strong proponent of AIDS education in schools, says he thinks the program, if administered carefully, is a good one.
If the patient is being identified with the blood, then the patient should definitely be informed. But if the blood is just blood and it's pooled blood of people, you know, that have blood drawn on for other reasons, and there's no way to identify where that blood came from except that it was from a person in the general population, and then the test is done, then fine, we'll get an idea of the prevalence in the general population, and nobody will be the worse off for it. Although you could say, well, really, what about the positive patients? Should they be informed? Well, they should really, from the educational campaigns and stuff, know that if they were exposed or at risk, they have the opportunity to find out their test results anyway. So as long as, and for free in the state, so as long as that opportunity is there and they can do it for free themselves, then I guess I wouldn't have a problem with it.
Representatives of the New York Civil Liberties Union also support the new testing project as long as the anonymity of patients is strictly adhered to. I'm Dave Galletly.
As we do regularly on the Legislative Gazette, Lieutenant Governor Stan Lundeen got on the phone this week. Lundeen is increasingly involved in the area of economic development. I spoke with him as he returned from yet another trip to an industrial area on Long Island.
I was out at Grumman this afternoon, and they are an industry with over 25,000 employees in New York. That's very much at a turning point. They have a lot of opportunity ahead, but they also have some problems, which presents a real challenge for those of us that want to be partners with industry. I'm going upstate to talk about labor management cooperation with some of the practitioners from Buffalo and Niagara Falls and Rochester.
Now, Stanley, I know you're an expert in this, but it sounds so boring. Labor management, I mean, to most of the people, they could care less. Is this a way for a lieutenant governor to be spending his time? And at very least, what is it?
What it is jobs. We've seen again and again where labor and management collaborate together, they can revitalize economies and create jobs. And that's, to me, as exciting as anything, because it makes taxpayers out of people who were previously required to subsist on transfer payments.
But when we say labor management, doesn't that always mean, isn't that always good for management and lousy for labor? Doesn't labor almost always have to be co-opted to cooperate and not strike in a situation like that?
I don't think so at all. Apart from the collective bargaining process that essentially divides up the fruits of people's productivity, you also have the question of whether we're going to have enterprises, whether we're going to have profits, whether we're going to have jobs, and what is the ultimate capacity of these enterprises to support their employees. In that, I think that labor and management have a mutual interest, a common interest, rather than a conflicting one.
Well, now you've made your reputation in this field, really. Could you give us one example of where the two come together, maybe using Grumman as an example?
Well, if we're able to have Grumman successful in competing for some of the most far-sighted programs that the U.S. military and foreign military are developing, that is going to mean opportunities on Long Island and elsewhere in New York. And if labor is willing to give some work rule concessions, and they're able to cooperate better, achieve higher levels of productivity, that success may be enhanced. So that's how the whole system works in order to bring more jobs into the state through their cooperation.
Now, we have heard over and over again about corporations being set up, semi-public corporations, in which labor and management sit on committees, or even labor takes a seat on a privately held board of directors. Isn't there always the risk then that that labor won't go out and fight for wages and things and will be co-opted?
I think there is a valid point of view that says labor on the board of directors creates a conflict of interest for the union representative. It seems to me that labor and business have common objectives where they can cooperate, but putting the union head on the board of directors, whose loyalty has to be to the bottom line of the corporation, could conceivably create a conflicting objective for that labor leader. That movement called co-determination has gained great popularity in Europe. It's not nearly as popular here. I think that it's a good thing to experiment with it, and I supported labor going on the board of Chrysler when that was subject because of the federal loan guarantees, but I don't think it's a panacea. I don't think that we know all the results in the American system as to whether it will enhance understanding between the workers and the corporation by having union representatives on the board.
Crystal ball, do you think we're going to see more of it or less of it?
I would think we're going to see more of it. I particularly think we're going to see it through vehicles such as employee ownership. 3% of the people in this country own 96% of the equity stock in corporations in America, and that does not suggest a strong middle-class interest in the entire enterprise of equity investment in America. I think you need more employee-owned companies, more community-owned enterprises, and as you do that, inevitably you're going to get laboring people put on boards of directors, so I think you're going to see more of it in the future.
The last question, I'm sure somebody's thinking out there, it sounds a lot like socialism or communism to me.
Not at all.
Now, that isn't not me, but I'm just saying that that'll be brought
up. Socialism is government ownership. We're not talking about government ownership of anything here. What we're talking about is private ownership, but what we're talking about is those who are stakeholders, that is employees in an enterprise, being stockholders, that is the partial owners of an enterprise, and from Sears, a major retailer, to small companies in this state that I can name, I think there's a pretty positive experience that when you get more of your employees owning a portion of the enterprise, they care more, and therefore they produce more.
Lieutenant Governor Stan Lundeen. A proposed 344-mile natural gas pipeline from Canada to Long Island is drawing criticism from residents and officials along the route. The Legislative Gazette's Maury Small reports.
The Iroquois gas pipeline would carry natural gas to regional utility companies in northern and eastern New York and western Connecticut. It would run across Long Island Sound to Long Island. The Iroquois Gas Transmission System, the consortium of gas and electric companies that wants to build the pipeline, is hoping to get federal approval by early next year. But the project is raising concern among residents and officials along the route. At public hearings in New York held by the Public Service Commission, farmers have discovered that the proposed pipeline would run right through their farms. Environmental groups in both New York and Connecticut worry that the clear-cut path for the pipeline will be unsightly and that trenching for it might divert water, reducing residential water supplies. The Iroquois Consortium says it's responding to those concerns and is drawing up environmental impact reports. But Charles Shaw disagrees. Shaw is executive director of the Environmental Management Council in Dutchess County, a citizen's advisory group. He says that because of opposition to the pipeline in Connecticut, Iroquois has moved much of what's called the preferred route for the pipeline out of Connecticut and into Dutchess County. Shaw says Iroquois has not studied the environmental effects of the pipeline there, and he says if Iroquois had decided on an adequate route to begin with, these route changes would not be necessary. Shaw says Iroquois is making communities determine the route.
The burden of proof issue is a big one with us. And so far, you said it in the beginning in this interview, that, well, Iroquois is saying that they're citing the line and to take into consideration homeowner concerns and agency concerns. Well, when you look at it from that perspective, who's really citing the line? Is Iroquois citing it, or are the residents citing it? We're not supposed to be in a position of citing a line. We're supposed to be in a position of reviewing what's been cited and expending our county resources and our public resources, reviewing and making recommendations. But what Iroquois has been able to do is manipulate the process and force the residents of Dutchess County and Columbia County, the state agencies, and everyone else into a siting procedure. And so all this testimony and everything, if you say something at a public hearing, and we've seen residents come in and say, hey, I have a wetland, or a major concern, I have you're going right next to my house or you're going right next to my well, and you come near me and I'll have my attorneys on you, you're not going to come on my land, that's great. But when people do that, Iroquois moves the line to someone else's property. And then it becomes a line of least resistance, not a line cited on environmental concerns. And that's what we're experiencing down here.
But Iroquois spokesman Michael Lucy of J. Mikowski Associates in Boston, an investor in the pipeline, says Iroquois is doing detailed environmental studies in all areas of the preferred route. He also rejects the charge that the Iroquois Consortium simply moved the route out of Connecticut because of stiff opposition to the pipeline there.
We moved the pipeline over to Dutchess County because Central Hudson needs and wants gas, and the route is environmentally better using overhead power lines. We were drawn to Dutchess County. We will still build it through Litchfield County if we have to. We don't want to. We'd prefer to build it in Dutchess because it's a better route. There's more gas markets there to serve. Central Hudson has already stepped up and wants gas, and there are more potential users beyond that. And as I say, there's an existing utility corridor to use.
The utility corridor is already a clear-cut path where Iroquois could lay the pipeline. Lucy does say that in some cases Iroquois is moving the preferred route because of opposition, for example, from farmers and other residents who don't want the pipeline passing through their property. Farmers are also assured that they could plant over the pipeline with no harm to crops. But there are other conflicts going on around the proposed Iroquois gas pipeline. Connecticut officials charge that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, is not doing its job. The FERC will eventually rule on the Iroquois proposal. Connecticut Assistant Attorney General Will Gundling says FERC should be actively seeking out the best natural gas solution for the Northeast rather than simply approving or denying the proposal from Iroquois.
Connecticut really doesn't see any reason why the process has to essentially reward the swiftest. I mean, just because you're the first person to file an application doesn't mean that your system is the best. And I think the responsibility rests with FERC to find the best system. And if it takes a little longer, so be it. But what FERC has attempted to do, they've attempted to streamline the certification process. And in streamlining, they've cut out the heart of their responsibilities, and that's to determine what systems serve the public interest and not what systems can be built the quickest.
Connecticut is not holding its own state hearings on the pipeline like the New York Public Service Commission is doing. Connecticut has asked the Federal Commission to hold the hearings in Connecticut. Amid questions about the Iroquois gas pipeline, the biggest question of all is whether there's really a need for a 344-mile natural gas pipeline from Canada to Long Island. Utility companies are testifying at hearings in New York that there is a need for the gas, but Gundling notes that many of these companies are partial owners of the pipeline and so have a special interest in seeing it built. The Connecticut Assistant Attorney General also notes that utilities have paid high fees to reserve rights to buy gas from the pipeline and have thus already paid for 75% of the construction costs. Gundling says the utilities are passing the cost of that outlay onto their customers so that, in effect, natural gas customers are already paying for the Iroquois gas pipeline, whether or not it is ever built. For the Legislative Gazette, this is Maury Small.
Another New York State senator has potential legal problems. Last weekend, Queens Democrat Andrew Jenkins, a protege of the late Queensborough President Donald Manus, was arrested by the FBI in an alleged scheme to take thousands of dollars out of the U.S. to Africa illegally. Jenkins eclipsed the problems of Republican Richard Schermerhorn of Orange County, who was named in a New York trial as having taken organized crime dollars to influence a Hudson Valley construction project. Jenkins, a member of the Black and Puerto Rican Caucus, was defended by fellow Democratic Senator David Patterson of Manhattan. Following citations of this support in newspaper accounts of Jenkins' arrest, the Legislative Gazette's Brenda McMahon talked with Patterson.
I won't minimize the gravity of the charges against Senator Jenkins, nor my concern for just the charge itself that's very serious, nor my concern for what this does to the perception of elected officials. However, I think that we have shoveled many an elected official into the grave before they've had the opportunity to vindicate themselves and to tell their side of the story. And in the most recent Chavon case that involved Senator Galver, he was acquitted after years of probably the public attention of thinking that he would be convicted of a crime, and he was acquitted of a crime. And so therefore, I wouldn't want people to rush to judgment about a colleague of mine who is a leader on the floor of the Senate, who has an excellent command of the issues, and has the type of character and personality that shocked all of his colleagues when we heard that he was arrested on this charge. Relating to the charge itself, I don't really know what it is they're going to convict him of. He didn't fill out a form. He didn't fill out the necessary documents to take more than $10,000 out of the country. However, he didn't leave the country. So therefore, the fact that he said he wasn't going to fill out the forms is kind of speculative. It relates to acts in the future, and I don't know how you can convict people of crimes for what they say they're going to do, or I would suggest that all of us would have been convicted a long time ago about different things we said we were going to do.
You were quoted in this article as saying, Senator Jenkins told you that, quote, someone was out to get me. Do you know who this someone is?
No, he just made a statement once that he had been, we were talking about wiretapping and surveillance, and he said that he'd been wiretapped and that he had been investigated, and that he figured somebody was out to get him. But since he was aware of it, he wasn't going to, in other words, he was just going to document this information and report it one day. So we haven't heard from Senator Jenkins on this yet, and therefore, you know, he might have some interesting things to say when he has his opportunity.
Do you think, because this happened, obviously it's a very sensitive time in the legislature now and for public officials, both on the national and the state level, how do you think this, just another incident, will affect that?
I think it's very sad because even the allegation inures to the detriment of elected officials in the public eye. Unfortunately, just the charge and the reporting of it is tantamount to problems for the accused. And it's a very sad situation to be in, that you've been accused, you haven't had a chance to defend yourself, and you are drawn and quartered by individuals who've heard about it, to such an extent that years later, sometimes people can't remember whether you were convicted or not. But just in terms of the perception of public officials, it's another blow. It's another damaging revelation. And where I blame elected officials and appointed officials who serve government is that there have been far too many times when these allegations were proved in court, and there were convictions.
State Senator David Patterson of Manhattan. Dave Gillette has joined us once again to discuss this continuing ethics problem. David?
Why are we now seeing all these revelations at once?
Well, a number of things. Of course, the more scrutiny that a legislative body or anybody gets under, the more heat turns up, the more prosecutors begin to look. And there's a sort of a way in which you prosecutors look at these things. Now, a couple of things that Senator Patterson said that are very interesting. It doesn't really matter, it seems to me, whether or not people are out to get you. We have all been, somebody has been out to get everybody, people at this radio station, other places. The real question here is whether or not there is something that an individual has done that they can be gotten for. And I think that's the kind of thing that we watch here. Now, where he says he doesn't know whether this guy, having taken $150,000 from the FBI, which is the allegation, in order to take it out of the country, was going to actually take it out of the country, I think that's probably begging the question. On videotape, apparently, he takes the $150,000 and he agrees to take it out of the country. That seems to me to be the essence of the argument and maybe a conspiracy.
But we are likely to see a lot more in this developing situation, not only with Senator Jenkins, but many other senators.
Well, I don't know about that, but we'll certainly have to follow this. Well, David, thank you. That's the Legislative Gazette for this week. Thanks to Maury Small, Brenda McMahon, Dan Analek, Selma Kaplan, and to this week's producer, especially Dave Gillette. I'm Alan Chartok.
The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC News. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. This program is made possible with funds provided by the State University College at New Paltz.
Statewide satellite distribution of this program was made possible by the Lawrence Group, providing residents throughout New York State with total insurance coverage.